The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Coming up on episode 272 of Wheel Bearings, we've got updated software for the Lucid Air, the Nissan Z, the Toyota GR Corolla. Somebody is still putting money into Faraday Future, and some new Porsche EV news. All that and more coming up next. This is episode 272 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam McGuall Samet from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from Ars Technica.
All right. And we're actually recording this the day after I recorded yesterday with Nicole, episode 271, because she's on her way to LA right now to do what you were doing yesterday, which is driving cars for World Car of the Year, right?
Yeah, we passed each other in the sky. I don't know if that's actually happened. I think I got home last night. I think she left this morning.
Yeah, I think so too. And then she'll, while she's in LA, she's also going to hit up the LA Auto Show to see what little there is to see there. And then we'll on our next episode, we'll hopefully all three of us will get back together again, and we can talk about some of that stuff. But
back together, getting the band back together.
But in the meantime, what have you been driving?
So I have been driving yesterday I drove a lot of cars, but I can't talk about all of them. And so first I'm just going to talk about the car that's in my driveway right now, and that is the Nissan Z. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, the Z, the Fair Lady, whatever you want to call it. It's Nissan's longtime sports car. You have the Roadsters, you have the 260Z, the 280ZX, Z's from the beginning of time. As far as Nissan,
or at least since 1970.
Yeah, as far as Nissan is concerned, or Datsun at the, you know, back in the day, it's a fun. It's a rear wheel drive. It's a sports car. It starts at $40,000. It has 400 horsepower, 350 foot pounds of torque. Obviously, I got the manual. If I hadn't got the manual, I would have been very upset, because there is a section of cars that require a manual, and I think it's this sort of enthusiast sports car that costs less than, you know, $50,000. It's, you know, the Miatas, the BRZs, the Corolla GR or GR Corollas, the Nissan Zs, you know, and so on and so forth. So these are a very special set of cars, because these cars aren't going to sell a lot. You're not going to sell a lot of these cars, but the people who buy them are very passionate. So a lot of people, I've had people following me in this vehicle and taking video. I've had people waving to me, giving me a thumbs up.
What color did you have?
I got the blue one.
Ooh, I like that color.
Yeah, so I got the blue one. It looks really, it's a very pretty car. My wife says it's pretty. She likes the way it looks. My wife is very, very, she is not easy to please when it comes to cars. I will come out and I'm like, look at this cool car. She's like, no. So if she likes it, then that's a thumbs up. Good job, Nissan. it is as a driver's car, it's fun. You know, you're gonna have fun. You can loosen it up. You can break that free. You know,
well, it's got correct wheel drive. Yeah. Drives the rear wheels and steers with the fronts.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, you know, you can break in. Break out the back end. It's a, you know, manual transmission. It has everything that you want from that sort of vehicle. And so I'm very happy, because Nissan, again, I think I've said this again and again, for years they were just seemed to be lost in the weeds. They were essentially the car that you got at the car rental place, and then this is a nice return to form. It's, you know, it's exactly what it needs to be, except. And here's the thing, is that I'm saying except because I'm thinking about other people. For me, it's not really that big of a deal, because I own a BRZ, which has the worst infotainment system on the planet. It you can plug in an iPhone. That's the best thing you can do. It doesn't have CarPlay or anything. But anyway, but the Nissan Z, the infotainment, everything kind of feels a little old inside. Everything feels, it doesn't feel like they put their best foot forward when it comes to the layout of the interior. Especially when it comes to like infotainment and the controls. When you have it does have auto climate controls, but when you turn the little dial, there's no digital number, there's no nothing. There's like a little 60 and a teeny tiny little 75 yeah. on the middle dial, and it's so small. It's actually kind of I'm like, what is that? And you're like, oh, that's the temperature, and you turn it to like what temperature you want. So that's how you sort of like, oh, well, I'm right here between 60 and 75, so I'm at 70 degrees, you know, that sort of thing. And there's like, yeah, all the little buttons in the climate control are actually a bit, the labeling is a bit too small. I think it's, there's, you know, that's sort of an issue. The infotainment system feels dated. It's, you know, it works. You can, and you know, you're just going to plug your phone into it. So that's fine. That said, that's not really what these cars are about. I think some people are going to take, you know, they're going to be like, oh, this isn't really that nice, or this isn't. That's get an Audi, really, yeah. is what I'm telling you. If you're looking for a performance vehicle that also has this very nice infotainment system, get an Audi, get a BMW, get a, you know. If you're looking for a manual transmission, I feel like the trade-off is you're just going to, the interior stuff, the controls don't matter. It doesn't.
As long as your primary driving controls are in the right places and work,
yeah, you know, everything,
shifter, pedals, steering wheel, you're good.
That's it. That's all you need, and that's what it has. It's I've been driving it for a little over a week. I think it has cruise control. I don't know. That's the thing if you have a manual transmission, I just don't even bother with cruise control or you know. Just because, first of all, I don't really like cruise control on its own. Adaptive cruise control and manual transmission just seems like a recipe for failure. It's a fun back roads, cruising around town, impressing your friends, having people come up to you at the gas station saying, hey, how do you like it? And then me explain to them, it's not my car, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. Giving them essentially the same spiel I'm giving you now, except in 5 seconds. It has launch control. It's a fun car. It's, you know, it is definitely a driver's car. It is not the car that you buy for someone who just wants to kick back and get from point A to point B. It's for someone who wants to lean forward and have that driving experience. Again, it's the Miata, the BRZ, the GR Corolla, the M2 BMW crowd. It's the people who are keeping the manual transmission alive, those folks. And yeah, there's a lot of, you know, I people are always like, oh, millennials, Gen Z, Gen whatever, they don't know how to drive manual transmission. They're buying these cars with manual transmission. Yeah. So yeah, they kind
of
do.
A few of them are
not as many as I would like, but if you are an adult in their 40s or 50s and you have children and you didn't teach them to drive a manual transmission, this is all your fault. If you're a parent and you didn't teach your kid, you're the problem. I don't ever want to hear you complain about how manual transmission is a, you know, Gen Z theft deterrent. No, you created this problem. Also, go buy manual transmission cars. That's my
spiel. I've done both. I buy manual transmission cars. I attempted to teach both of my kids to drive a manual, one successfully, the other one not so much. I did what I could.
That's all you can do. And also, if you don't want to learn how to drive a manual transmission, that is totally fine. There's literally no reason for you to, if you don't want to do that. And you're not less of a driver, by the way. You're not less of a car person because you can't drive a manual. You're not less of a car person because if you don't work on cars, there's all different layers of car people. Mm-hmm.
It's a spectrum.
It's a spectrum. There is a spectrum of car people. But yeah, it's if you love manual transmissions and you complain about manual transmissions not being available, you better go out and buy a car with a manual transmission. Period. The end.
Totally agree. Couldn't agree more.
And then yesterday, I just want to talk about this one car from yesterday, from my drive of like eight different cars. I drove the 2023 Toyota GR Corolla Circuit Edition.
Ooh.
And that was a fun car. It's amazing how you can just pull, you know, 300 horsepower out of a 1.6 liter three cylinder engine. It's you know, it's got a turbo on it, obviously, to, you know, to get up there. But it's got a manual transmission. I think someone turned off the rev matching, which, thank God. I'd rather just do that myself. The rev matching on the Z, the rev match, I'm like, enough. If rev matching is cool and fun, but it's funner if you kind of learn how to do it. I drove the GR Corolla on Angeles Crest Highway. And it was fantastic. I cannot say enough good things about this vehicle. It is the hot hatch. It is the quintessential. It's small, it's agile, it's fast, it handles like there's no tomorrow. It is ridiculous. Everything about this vehicle is ridiculous, and I want one so bad. And I'd seen some people are like, oh, you know, the GR Corolla, it's really great, and people were very excited about it when it came out, and I was just like, you know, I like the styling of the new Corolla, the new hatchback, and I was like, oh, okay. Man, the hype, yes, the hype is real. It is a wonderful vehicle. Good luck getting one, by the way. I don't know how. I just figured this.
Yeah, I'm sure they probably won't build very many of them.
Yeah, which is a shame, because if people keep wanting it, you should keep building it. Don't be like, well, we're only going to sell 5,000 units, so we're only going to make. But if like 10,000 people want it, I don't know, make 10,000. I don't.
Or at least 9,990 of them.
Yeah.
As I think, I can't remember if it was Enzo Ferrari or somebody said, you know, always build exactly one fewer than there are demand.
Yeah, do that. I don't know. I feel like Toyota has, there's the spectrum of Toyota is pretty wide. You have these very solid, slightly boring cars. You know, the RAV4 is a wonderful vehicle. Is it exciting?
No.
It's a RAV4. Yeah. The Camry, the regular Corolla. Again, wonderful vehicles. Exciting? Not so much. And then on the other side, they have the Supra. They have the GR86. And now they have this GR Corolla, which, man, I mean, I had the 300 horsepower one. You can get, but I think they start at 30,000. This one starts at 43,000. So you're paying a premium for that extra horsepower. But even the $30,000 one, that is a...
Well, you also get a carbon fiber roof on the Circuit Edition.
That's true, but it's...
Torsen diffs at both
ends. It just looks like your roof is dirty all the time. And the Torsen diffs are great, especially on that back row, on that Andros Crest Highway. That thing was... It was just tearing it up. And it's such a... You know, that's the teeny tiny wheelbase is about as long as my arm.
Yeah.
I was just like, you know, it was tearing up the road, and then, you know, and then I kept getting stuck behind Porsche people, who don't know how to drive, and people who are just commuting on that road, which I always feel bad for those people, because they're always just like, these idiots again.
So
I'm just trying to get to work, and these idiots and their GR Corollas.
Would you take this or a Civic Type R?
Oh, I would take this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the Civic Type R. I think the way they have, I don't know what sort of magician or sorcerer or whoever who got rid of like all, you know, at least reduced understeer. I don't know how they did that. That's just, they're just magicians over there at Honda to do that. But this is something else. This is something very, very special. Are we going to get something like this again?
I would be surprised.
Yeah, I think this is.
I'd be surprised if there's a second generation of this car.
Yeah, and who else is going to make something like this? I mean, we have WRX, which is, you know, the WRX, but this is this is next level insanity.
You got stuff like the Golf R, which is kind of a very different kind of car from this.
I think the Golf R has been very smoothed out over the last two generations, which is, you know, I think I think for your average sort of enthusiast, you just want to like, hey, I got the Golf R, that's fine. But for the hardcore people who bought the Golf R because of this sort of white knuckling, like shoving, you know, tossing it in the second gear, and then you know, those folks are, you know, they're slightly disappointed. I prefer the GTI at this point. Mm-hmm. Over the R now.
So do I, because it's lighter and more nimble. Even though it doesn't have as much power, it's easier to throw around. The Golf R has so much capability that, you know, it almost feels it's too smooth. You know, it feels like it's running on rails.
Yeah. It feels a little. It doesn't have that sort of that white knuckling.
None of that edginess.
Yeah, the edginess is sort of gone. It's a wonderful car, and if you're looking for a performance all-wheel drive vehicle that you're going to have fun in, but you're not, but you're also going to feel a bit safe.
Yeah,
the Golf R is the one. That's the it's the safer choice between that and the GR. The GR Corolla, you're just like, oh my god, let's try this a little bit faster. Let's try this a little bit quicker. Let's try this a little bit tighter. And he's just like, yeah, let's do this. It's like your crazy meth-addled, like college roommate who kept talking you into going to raves.
If that circuit edition's not enough for you, you know, there's also the Marizo edition, which they announced at the Toyota Palooza in June, where Marizo is the nickname of Akio Toyota. And so this one is a lighter weight version. It has the same power, same 300 horsepower. But it's a two-seater. They took out the back seat. They added some stiffening stuff, and it's manual only. It's got front brake cooling ducts, different seats in it with higher, more stiffer bolsters, bigger bolsters, and holes for a 4-point harness. So
that's your track car. That's the car you're taking to the track.
Yeah. But they're only going to have 200 of those in the U.S.
And it's already sold out, I'm sure.
Almost certainly, yeah.
So, yeah, the Circuit Edition, fantastic. I mean, I haven't driven the entry-level version, but I'm sure it's fine. I think you're going to have just as much fun in that vehicle as you would in this one. Especially if you're younger and you're sort of newer to this sort of driving experience, maybe don't get the most powerful one.
They're actually all the same 300 horsepower.
Oh, they are? Oh, I thought the other one was a little
bit there's lower. No extra power, just some suspension tweaks, I think different tires.
Never mind then. Then ignore me. Ignore everything I just said. Either way.
You do get slightly more torque. So the core is 273 foot-pounds, and the circuit's also 273. So the circuit's exactly the same. The Marizo has 295 foot-pounds of torque. So you get an extra 22 foot-pounds of torque, same horsepower.
A little extra something.
Yeah.
Buy this car. If you have the money and you like driving and you're into performance driving and into hot hatches, you know, Americans are always, you know, people are like, oh, there's no hatchbacks. I'm like, have you seen? There's a Golf right there.
Yeah.
People are like, how come no one ever sells a hatchback? And I'm just looking at the Golf. I'm like, what do you mean? What do you mean there's no hatch there? And then they bring hatchbacks, and then no one buys them, and then they go away, and then we all have SUVs. So you have to, you can't complain if you're not buying. And if you are buying, and you're like me, and you're just like, oh well, I am buying, but I can't get my friends to buy, then I understand. I'm sorry.
Yeah. All right. I had actually had it. The last time that you and I talked, a little over a week ago, the Lucid Air. I'd had it back in September when I was out in California for a couple of days. Drove it from L.A. up to Santa Barbara and back with a detour through some canyons. At that time, the car still had the original version of the infotainment software in it. And about 3 or so weeks ago, Lucid put out a completely updated version of the software they basically almost completely rewrote it from the ground up, added a bunch of new features.
90%!
Yeah.
Just for the infotainment system, 90% of the code is new.
Yeah. Because of an issue I had that I think I talked about before, where at one point the system had completely locked up on me, Lucid reached out and said, hey, we've got a car in Detroit. You know, it's got the new software in it. We'd like to get you in it for a couple of days to try it out so you can see what the new UX 2.0 is like. And I said, well, okay, if you twist my arm and you insist, you know, I will drive it again for a couple of days.
Fine. If you're going to make me drive another Lucid.
And so this was, again, a Grand Touring. And this was on the 21-inch wheels. So there's two variants of the Grand Touring that are available right now. And I think later this week, as we're recording, I think on Wednesday or Thursday, Lucid's going to be officially announcing the base Pure Edition and I think I forget what the other trim level
touring.
Is.
Just Touring.
Touring, yeah. So the Pure and the Touring. But the Grand Touring has two variants. The standard Grand Touring has 819 horsepower. And if that's not enough for you, and what the hell's wrong with you if it's not enough for you in a car like this, you can get the Grand Touring Performance with 1,050 horsepower. And I had the variant with the 21-inch wheels. And if you live somewhere in northern parts of the country where they get winter weather and correspondingly terrible roads, and you want to get a Lucid, this is not just about Lucid. I would say pretty much any car. Don't get the biggest wheels and tires you can get. Don't, or at least not the biggest wheels with the absolute least amount of sidewall. It looks cool when it's sitting there, but you know if you look at a pothole, there's a good chance you're gonna break a tire or bend a wheel.
You're gonna go where you look, by the way. So if you look at the pothole, you're just gonna drive right into it.
And, so I went out to dinner with my wife. And coming back, hit a pothole, which was not a particularly big pothole by Southeast Michigan standards. And then I heard this hissing sound. What is that sound? And I slowed down, and it slowed down a little bit, and I stopped, and the hissing kind of stopped. And I got out, and I looked at the right or the left front tire, and I saw that, ooh, that's not good. it had gone a little bit flat, not too flat, because you know with so little sidewall, there's not much room for it to kind of flex out and look flat.
It's just a rubber band over a tire,
pretty much. Over a wheel. And I wasn't far from home, so I managed to I crept along, you know, at about 10 miles an hour to get home and get into the driveway, because I didn't want to leave it in a random neighborhood. And then sent an email to my contacts at Lucid and at the fleet company that brought it over and said, hey, you guys don't happen to have a spare wheel and tire for this thing, do you? Because if not, you're going to need to bring over a flatbed on Monday when you come to pick it up. And this was on Friday night.
It's always the worst when it's like on the weekend.
Yeah, so Dave got back to me and said, we can get a mobile service unit out to you tomorrow. And so mobile service van came out. It was based in Grand Rapids, which is on the west side of Michigan. I'm in the southeast side of Michigan. It's about a 2.5-hour drive away.
Oof.
But he had to stop by Coldwater, Michigan, to pick up a wheel and tire and then come to my house. And so they finally got here about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And he was actually, while the last time you and I were recording, he arrived and was changing that tire. And so then after he left, then, I was able to drive it some more, and I made sure to be more careful about the potholes and stuff. And I took it out on Sunday morning for a couple of hours and drove around, and had a lot of fun with it, really enjoyed driving it. And the new software is definitely a big improvement. I mean, you also had a chance to drive it with UX 2.0. What did you think of it?
It is such an improvement because I'd driven a bunch of Lucid Airs over, I don't know, however long it's been.
About a year.
About a year. So I live in the Bay Area. I've done a lot of it. I've happened to do a lot of exclusives with Lucid before. So I'm on their short list, essentially, which isn't a brag. It's just why I've driven the car so often. I remember the first car reviewed, you know, you push a button and something, you wait a little bit. Sometimes it would go, and then sometimes it'd be like, hey, you need to hold on. And they were very forthcoming. They're like, hey, this is pre-production. This is kind of... And then the next vehicle was production. And it's still like it needed, you know, you could tell it needed something. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't Volkswagen, you know, ID4 at launch bad, but it wasn't, you know, great. And now, you know, with the new rewrite, it's so much quicker. And, you know, a lot of this has to do with the guy who's running is from Apple. I mean, he's like, I know over the air updates. I know how these work. I know how to write, you know, I have to write stuff for an iPhone, which millions and millions of people have to use. And it can't be like janky. You know, it has to be quick. It has to be fast because you're going up against Android. And I guess at some point, BlackBerry and Windows. But yeah, so it is so much quicker than it was before. You know, in my time with it, I think I had an hour and a half, and I was just like clicking around like crazy, just trying to see if I could get it to slow down. And you know, and it, you know, there's very little latency. They also moved those buttons over to the left hand side, those sort of hot buttons. They were on the right hand side, which was sort of weird. So it was great for the passenger. Hey, can you hit the and so they moved that over. They moved the button to open the frunk over to the left hand. You know, they made a bunch of adjustments based on feedback from customers and based on just sort of like looking at it and be like, oh, we thought this was a good idea. Turns out, let's do this instead. And so, it's good. You know, you have to keep moving, especially in, you know, in any company. If you're not moving, you're dying. Is really what it comes to. So if you're not learning, if you're not moving, then you're doing yourself and your customers a disservice. So I think it's, you know, like they could have just sped it up and then just left it how it is and said, hey, you know what, we know what's best. Instead, they like sped it up and listened to their customers. So, but
yeah, no, I agree. It was definitely much better. The one kind of complaint I still have is that you know, you've got the upper displays, you know, the cockpit panel, mm-hmm. I think it is. Where you've got, you know, the little set of controls on the left, the instrument cluster, and your main infotainment screen. And then there's what they call the pilot panel, which is the other touch screen that
at the bottom
retracts into the dashboard below the vents. And then, you know, you tap on it, and it comes out and tap and flips down and gives you some extra screen real estate there. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I would still like to see them change is offer the ability to have different things on the top and bottom screen. Because right now, you know, if you are in navigation, you know, you get on the lower screen, you'll kind of get kind of an overview of your route, and then you know the zoomed in version on the upper screen. If you go to media controls, you get, you know, some media controls on the top, and then, you know, other stuff, media related stuff down on the bottom screen. What I'd like is to have, you know, let's say navigation control, you know, the navigation view on the top, and then the media controls on the bottom, or, you know, some combination of two different things.
Yeah.
So
I want to be able
accessible.
To control media and see where I'm going at the same
yeah,
time.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm sure they'll probably say, well, you also have navigation on the dash cluster. I'm like, no, that is not the I want two things. You got two screens. Two screens shouldn't be run by one thing.
All right. But other than that, I mean, you know, and that's a relatively minor quibble. I mean, this is still a fantastic car. I still really like driving this car. I love the way it looks. You know, I love the way everything feels inside, you know, and I think that they've done a pretty nice job of balancing, you know, stuff that's in the touchscreen interface and some physical controls. You know, you've got a row of switches across the middle of the dash, you know, for the temperature and fan speed for the front passenger and driver, and then the volume control in the middle there, you know, so you don't have to go searching in the cluster or in the touchscreens for that. Some of the controls for the wipers, like for, you know, for wiper speed for the intermittent wipers, is in the touch interface, but your basic controls to turn it on and off and stuff is on the stock. And, you know, same thing goes with the I think it's on the left-hand side, that little left-hand side control panel for the wipers. But at any rate, the stuff is mostly readily accessible, and you don't have to go digging, for the most part, through multiple layers of menus. So they're good job, Lucid. You know, you're moving in the right direction. It's improving. It's gotten a lot better, and looking forward to UX 3.0.
When you'll be able to have music and the map on the stage.
Exactly.
That's all we want. We just want two things at once.
Yeah. So that's the Lucid Air Grand Touring, $154,000. The Pure, which is going to be coming out soon, I think it's going to start around $88,000. There's also the Grand Touring Performance with 1,050 horsepower, and then the Sapphire, which is coming out, what was that, next year? Next summer, fall?
Yeah, something. Yeah, 1,200 horse, over 1,200. Yeah,
1,200 horsepower. And
it's just okay.
Yeah. Three motors, 1,200 horsepower.
0-60 in under 2 seconds. Okay, yeah. Sure. What, that, whatever. At some point, yeah. The
3 seconds, 2 seconds.
It doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, it's irrelevant at that point.
The 0-60 wars are over. It doesn't matter anymore. It's not a thing that we should even be concerned about, because everything can go. The EV6 can outrun a Huracan. So.
Yeah. One other thing that is not directly related to Lucid, but while I had it, I took it over to the EA station because I wanted to see, you know, how fast it would charge. And I got over there, and both of the 350 kilowatt chargers were in use. One was being used, and there was a couple of 150s that were not being used. One was being used by a Polestar 2. The other one was being used by a Chevy Bolt.
It's the Chevy Bolt is the one. That's the one you always talk about. Like, yeah, you're going to get the 350. Is going to be Bolt sitting there.
I love the Bolt, but you know, it only charges at 50 kilowatts.
It only charges at 50. And maybe if you're
lucky, the 350 kilowatt charger if there's a 150 available.
This is really comes down to people not understanding like how with their charge rates. And when automakers like push back on me asking how fast does it charge, and they only give me the time. Oh, it goes from like 5% to 80% in 15, 20, 30, 40 minutes. I'm like, no, what is the number? Because people need to know the number when they go to the charging
station. Electrify
America
is going to fix that, because they're going to put hypercharge and ultracharge stickers on those chargers. So that'll fix everything.
It only fixes it on their end. It doesn't fit, which I still can't remember which one's faster.
Neither do I. Is one should be like or ultra.
One should be fast, and the other should be hella fast. That's how, because you're like, oh, okay, I understand. This is fast plus or something. But yeah, when automakers don't give or don't readily share the charge rate of their vehicles, they're doing everyone a disservice, because you end up with Chevy Bolts
plugged into 350
kilowatt chargers. That's what happens. Like, just tell us what the charge rate is. And people are like, well, I've never cared about it. I'm like, yeah, but when you go to a charge station and you realize that your car that charges at 225 kilowatts is being blocked by a Chevy Bolt, then you're definitely going to realize, oh, that information should be given out to everyone from everyone. Because in the real world, it does matter.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. Apparently, there's still somebody out there who thinks that Faraday Future has a chance of
the
surviving.
The future.
That Faraday Future is the future. Evidently, according to Automotive News this morning, they have signed a deal to raise up to $350 million as they look to roll out the FF91. The company said that financing from an affiliate of Yorkville Advisors Global, starting with an initial commitment of $200 million, will give it financial flexibility to start production and deliver its cars to customers. Yeah, we'll see.
Yorkville Advisors Global. Let's just do a quick search on that. Since 2001, so it's not like they've been around. Flexible solutions. Yeah. Right.
Shareholders last week approved a reverse stock split after the company received a notice. One of the things when you're a public company, if your share price drops below a dollar a share for 30 straight trading days, you start to get emails from the stock market from the stock exchange saying, hey, you better do something about your stock price or we're going to have to delist you. And so that was the case with Faraday, and they approved a reverse stock split. So that means that, you know, they're going to combine shares, you know, that are, you know, so if, I'm not sure what the current share price is, but say it's 50 cents a share. You know, if it's a 10 for one or one for 10 reverse split, that'll bump the price up to $5. So that'll, you know, keep them on the listing for at least a few more weeks until the price drops again. So
it's such a, the fact that they're still around just is it sort of boggles my mind. Cause I remember when The Verge did a piece about it, was, they were just sort of falling apart. And they immediately had us all down to their headquarters in Hawthorne, I believe, or mm-hmm. Torrance, somewhere in L.A. Hawthorne or Torrance, somewhere around there. And we walked through, and, you know, they had a row of desks, but they're all, like, right next to where we were walking. They're like, oh, all this area where there's nobody right now is where we're going to expand. And they went down, they showed us the car, and we walked through, you know, the whole the headquarters. Oh, it was Gardena. This is right here in the article, is where their headquarters was. And we looked around, and they just kept saying how, like, oh, we're doing this, and we're going to do this all in-house, and we're going to do all this in-house, we're going to do all... Everything was going to be built in-house. And the more... The automotive reporters were just like, what? Why? Like, at some point... Because you don't... That's not how you build cars. You know, you do most... You have to outsource for a lot of things. You can't build every single thing in-house. You have to order things from tier one suppliers. That's why they're tier one suppliers. And they were just like, no, we're going to build it all. It was like, and by the end of the tour, based on all the stuff they had shown us, the car felt like it was going to be $350,000. It felt like it was going to be a $350,000 car. And you're just like, do these people know what's going on? Do they understand how to build? It felt very much like someone had given them some money and we're going to make a car. It'll be fun. It'll be great. But yeah, it felt, and since then they've gone through like 12, 15, 25 CEOs, and I don't think anyone who works there now worked there when I went on the tour. So it's going to be a fun Netflix documentary is what I'm telling you.
Yes. Or maybe a Hulu miniseries or something.
Or a Hulu miniseries.
From the creators of the We Crashed.
Yeah.
I remember a couple of months ago reading, Abigail Bassett wrote a piece in ours. She had a chance to go for a ride in the prototype or pre-production car at Monterey Car Week this week. It was summer. And she was not impressed.
Yeah, no, she was just like, because we've had so much time to work on this car. I in that tour back in, God, who knows when, they had us ride in mules. They had all-wheel drive mules. They were very proud that they were all-wheel drive. And they're like, yeah, they're all-wheel drive. And, of course, the car people, the first thing that popped out of my mouth was like, oh, like the Honda Prelude. Because remember the Honda Prelude in the 90s had an all-wheel drive version. Yeah. And they're like, no, like the, you know, and they're trying to come up with a newer vehicle. And, of course, you know, we all, you know, and I think they thought that we were, that the Prelude is a great car. that no generation of Prelude was bad. And but they were just like, no, because they were, you know, they wanted us to align it with a luxury brand. And they drove us around and we're like, okay, that's great. We're, you know, we're in essentially a mule with like no interior, no nothing in, on a parking lot. But yeah, it's been a minute and we still don't have a car and I don't know. We'll see. Maybe in 5 more years, we'll have the F1.
We'll see. I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah. No, no one should be holding their breath for an FF1, or whatever it's called now.
So, last week you went to Italy.
I went to Italy and I spent the entire time with Germans. It was it was funny because I got there and I had dinner with some Germans and then I was there with a German automaker and then when I got to the room the TV was in Italian and I was very confused.
Did they at least feed you Italian food?
Yeah, I guess they had some Italian food or something. It was a very, very quick trip where we ate at the hotel. And I'm going to share a little bit of information with you, viewers. Every hotel in the world has the exact same menu.
Yes.
I don't care what country you're in. I don't care if you're in Europe. I don't care if you're in Asia. I don't care if you're in Africa. I don't care if you're in the United States, Canada, Mexico. Everyone has essentially the exact same menu. And it's all that same level of just like, eh, it's food.
Yeah. Well, and that's especially true, you know, if you're on an automaker trip, you know, and they have a dinner, you know, because no matter what restaurant you're at, you know, hotel or outside of the hotel, you know, no matter what's on the normal menu there, they'll have a, when you sit down at dinner, you know, there will be a card there with the menu for that dinner. And, you know, they'll have, you know, salad, some appetizer, and then you'll have your choice of, you know, some form of beef, you know, like a fillet or, you know, some steak, you know, a chicken dish and usually a fish course, and then maybe a vegetarian as well, and then dessert. And, you know, you select if you want chicken, fish, or beef.
It's just like a wedding.
Yeah. Pretty much.
I'm flying around the world going to a wedding. Is what
you'd be at a three-star Michelin restaurant, and those are your choices. And it's pretty much the same thing every automaker trip you go on.
Yeah. Sometimes you'll get lucky.
It's usually
good. Yeah, it's usually good, but it's very nice sometimes when they take us away from the hotel and they go to, like, a local restaurant. You're like, yay, and they're just like, here's the menu. But most of the time, you're just, yeah. Anyway, so I'm in the hotel. I didn't have an exciting Italian adventure. I did get to drive the Taycan around Italy, so that was nice. But most part, I was at the Porsche Experience Center in Italy, and they showed off their PPE, their upcoming PPE platform, and they talked about what it means for, you know, the PPE is going to be for the Macan and the Cayenne. I always want to say Cheyenne because I was doing a drive program once, and me and Steve Ewing kept making a joke about the Cheyenne.
Was it a Cayenne program in Cheyenne?
It was a Cayenne program here in the Bay Area. But it's, you know, in those, and people are going to be like, oh, you know, those aren't real Porsches. The A, because they're SUVs, and B, because they're going to be EVs. They are real Porsches. If you've driven a Macan or a Cayenne, it drives just like a bigger, taller Porsche. It's not a, the reason Porsches cost so much is because getting a Porsche and drive it, and you'll know exactly why a Porsche costs so much. So they talked about PPE, talked a little bit about, and we talked about Formula E, the Gen 3 with the 99X. I got a ride in the GT4 E Performance, which is their electric race car, which is they're going to use to as a test bed to inform them on building EVs for their race car customers. You know, they're people who just buy, you know, very expensive Porsche race cars that they take to the track, and that's what they do. Overall, a lot of people are there. A lot of automakers are sort of like, well, this is our platform, and we have one platform, and Porsche has a couple platforms. You know, they're sharing these platforms with Audi, you know, PPE especially. They have the sports car platform, which will be for the Cayman, and then they have another platform which escapes me.
You get Cayman and Boxster and
Cayman and Boxster
911.
And 911 will likely be a hybrid. It's going to be the 911 EV is not something that we should be looking for, is what I've been told. Just because it feels like the 911 is a very special vehicle, and because it is special, they could, you know, I think they're going to try to keep an actual engine in that vehicle as long as possible. And Porsche has been doing a lot of work with biofuels and synthetic fuels. So I think that's where they're going with that vehicle. So don't look, you know, don't be on the lookout for a complete EV 911, at least not for a very long time. I think, you know, the Cayman, I'm very excited about a Cayman and a Boxster EV, especially after riding that GT4 E Performance. And I know that's like the craziest.
Yeah, I mean, they showed
crazies.
That one at the LA show last year.
Yeah, I know that's the craziest of the crazy of vehicles, but it's Porsche. You know, their whole deal is how do we make this a Porsche, and that's, you know, with the Taycan. I really believe that when the Taycan came out, all the chassis engineers at every other automaker drove the Taycan and went, oh man, let's go back and fix that thing. Because it drives, it's such a wonderful driving experience for a big EV, to be honest. I mean, it's a big sedan or it's a big wagon. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so, you know, I saw the Mule, the Macan Mule. It's not what the Macan's going to look like, the Macan EV. But they showed us the Mule. They gave us some information about how you know, they're making sure they're actually putting the motor, the rear motor, behind the rear axle in order to
get the Macan EV?
The Macan EV to get a little bit more rear bias driving because that's how Porsche thinks.
Yeah.
They're like, we're making, everyone else is like, we're going to make an EV and it's going to be nice and we'll just throw some suspension. Porsche's like, you know, if we move the engine a little bit behind here, it's going to get a little bit more weight back here. It's going to get a little bit more rear bias as you're driving, so you get more of a Porsche experience. That is how Porsche builds cars. And that's
with an EV, you know, usually the battery spans most of the distance between the axles, and that's the biggest chunk of weight. And so you usually end up with something that's pretty close to 50-50.
Yeah. And so Porsche's like, yeah, we're gonna change it a little bit. We're gonna move it over here to the back. And also get rear wheel steering, which is nice. Mm-hmm. Which I am a big fan of. Any large vehicle, any large SUV at this point, if you're not putting rear steering on a, you know, anything luxury or expensive, anything above $50,000-$60,000, you're messing up, is what.
Yeah. Anyway,
because once you go rear wheel steering on one of these vehicles, these large vehicles, you're just like, I can't see how I could do anything else. It was pretty impressive. And then they also showed off, you know, I said the 99X race vehicle, which they designed based on what they were told to make. Formula E. It's you know, it's like Formula One. They're like, okay, you have to make this car like this. And have to, like, adjust it within your, you know, you have the parameters, and then you design your car.
Yeah, well, with Formula E, the way it works is there's a spec chassis that everybody uses. Everybody gets the same chassis. But manufacturers can create their own drivetrain. And as you said, there's some specs, you know, and maximum power output. And, you know, there's also a spec battery. And, you know, within that, though, you know, they have some leeway to try to optimize efficiency, because that's really important in a race car. Because, you know, if everybody's got the same amount of battery capacity, if you want to go faster, you got to use less energy to do it. And
yeah, it's sort of crazy, because the amount of power that was sent back to regenerative braking on the Gen 2 vehicles was 250 kilowatts. So you slam on the brakes, and the most amount of power you send back to the vehicle is 250 kilowatts, which is essentially the charge rate of that vehicle. Mm-hmm. Now it's 600 kilowatts. So if you slam on the brakes, you can get up to 600 kilowatts back to the battery in that vehicle. So they were saying that the amount of power that was used in the race was like 25%, and now it is 40%. So it went from 25 to 40% of the amount of power. So when you're racing around, 25% of that power that you're using to finish your race was from regenerative braking, and now it's going to be 40%, which is a huge, huge jump. So you're going really fast and you're slamming the brakes pretty hard, but it's still, you know, it's all these little things are really, you know, it's interesting. And, you know, Formula E is only 45 minutes long. You just race until you send. So
it's a sprint.
Yeah, it's a sprint. There's a lot of passing. There's a lot of, like, bumping into each other. It's a very aggressive race. And, you know, they only have a certain amount of test days they can do. Mm-hmm. And so none of the test days involve them running into other cars. So they did all the stuff to the car. And someone is like, well, what happens if you run into the other car? We're like, I guess we'll just stay there. Just like,
we'll
kind of put their hands in the air, like, well, we'll see, hopefully it'll be okay. But that's, it's such a, you know, the it's really interesting. And I think I did a video about it, and I talk about how, you know, Formula One is the big one. You know, you got Lewis Hamilton, you got and you had the Netflix series, but Formula E, I've been to one race, and it's just so bonkers. Just like, we gotta go.
Yeah.
It is
pretty wild. I went to the New York race in 2019, and it's pretty intense. Seeing those cars, because they're on street circuits. You know, they're very tight street circuits, and yeah, they're not as fast as Formula One cars, but they look really cool. They make a really wild sound. You know, they sound kind of like Star Wars TIE fighters. But you mentioned, you know, the amount of regen braking they're getting now. And I think a big reason why it's getting so much more, you know, the last car, the old cars, only had the motor generator unit on the rear axle. They're rear wheel drive race cars. They only had the motor on the rear axle. There's a limit to how much regen braking you can do on the rear, because you know, as you brake, you get weight transfer off the rear axle, and if you brake too hard on the rear axle, then you know the car gets unstable and back end swings around. And so now they've added a motor generator unit on the front axle, which is not being used for all-wheel drive. It's just being used for regen. So you're getting all this regen off the front axle. So you can do a lot more regen. As I understand, there's not even any friction brakes on the rear axle now, right? On the new car?
I don't think so. Yeah, no, yeah. I was very confused by the press release. It was like, there's two powertrains, one in the front, one in the back. I'm like, wait, what? And then finally they had to explain to me, they're like, it's not all-wheel drive. I'm like, oh, it's only for regenerative braking. I'm like, oh, okay. That makes more sense. Because it's like,
so they're harvesting power from the front wheels and then putting it back out the back.
Yeah, so it's, you know, all this information that Porsche is learning from the GT4 e-Performance, from the Taycan, and from, you know, Formula E, they're going to be putting in these upcoming platforms, because that's who Porsche is. And based on like how nice the Taycan is, and it's been out for a couple of years now, you know, if you have any, I don't have any real concerns about driving an EV Porsche in the future. I feel like this is a company that really understands who they are, what they should be building, and their transfer or their evolution into EVs it seems like a, you know, I know it's a couple different platforms, but that's a smart play for them.
So when is the Macan EV going to come out?
The Macan EV comes out, I believe, next year. Hold on, I'm looking at my notes. I have so many notes for so many things going on. Oh, where is it at? 2024, when the Macan hits the market. So
we'll probably see it next year, and then go to sell the year after.
Yeah, they'll probably unveil it somewhere, and then we'll see it on the streets in 2024 at some point, and then we can see, you know, how PPE really works out.
Okay, cool. All right, we have one listener email, and as I mentioned last time when I was recording with Nicole, given all the chaos going on at Twitter, want to remind everybody that Twitter is not the only way to send us your questions and comments. You can also email us at feedback@wheelbearings.media, and that gives you, you know, if you want to ask a little bit longer question or a little more detail, you can do that. You know, I think I'm also going to probably set up a Discord server for Wheel Bearings, so you'll be able to provide feedback that way as well. We got one email. Jonathan Bonesteel already listened to the episode that I recorded with Nicole yesterday, after I put it out last night, and sent an email this morning. Says, enjoyed the episode last night. Realize your focus is not e-bikes, but wanted to share that there are very nice ones at a bit lower price point. Because one of the things I talked yesterday about, I tried out some e-bikes at the Electrify Expo in Austin, and they were all priced between about $4,000 and $6,000.
Oh my gosh. I got 10 e-bikes. No, 8 e-bikes in my garage right now. They're all under like $2,000.
Why do you have so many e-bikes?
Because I'm doing an e-bike roundup for USA Today. So e-bikes are dope. All right, sorry, carry on.
Anyway, so John says, my wife and I have had VanMoof X3 bikes for 2 years, and they're great. All in with a theft recovery system that promises that they will track down a stolen bike and return it to you or replace it if they can't find it. They were around $3,000 each. So that's quite a bit cheaper, and it sounds like you've got some that are even cheaper than that. And I was looking around. There's something like Rad Power bikes you can get for between $1,000 and $2,000.
Yeah, I got a Rad Power in the garage right now.
Yeah. So great design, and the boost is all you need for the hills around Ann Arbor or San Francisco. The newer models are even better. With the trails around Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti, I guess Jonathan lives not far from me here somewhere, I tool around all over the place and love it. On Volvo, We replaced our 2017 XC90 last week with a 2023 V60 Cross Country Ultimate, and we're very happy. You both are right on the movement away from physical buttons, which annoys me at times as well. On the V60, a couple of changes supporting our argument. I used to really like a manual dimmer wheel for the display. That's now gone, and you have to use the menu system to change it. Didn't try the Hey G word to do this, but perhaps this is the solution. Yeah, I haven't tried that with Google Assistant to see if that works. I know you can do adjust climate control and things like that with Assistant, but I don't know if you can do things like dim the cluster. He says he'll try later. Also, there used to be a button on the center stack of buttons for the glove box. Interesting choice, but I like the quirkiness of it. Now on the V60, it's back to a regular manual latch. Boo. Great car, though, and I love the mild hybrid drivetrain. So,
I will say that manual like buttons for glove boxes are actually pretty nice, because if you get in an accident and you have to like get information out of the glove box,
mm-hmm.
if the car's going wonky because you know you're in an accident,
or if you get pulled over and
you get pulled over, you're like, hold on, I gotta play Minecraft on my car in order to get to the thing.
One aside, when you use navigation with CarPlay, the map section in the center of the Speedo Tac display goes completely dark. That's something I didn't try out. I'll have to try that on the next Volvo I get, because you know, when you're using the Android automotive system, it shows Google Maps in the instrument cluster. So I guess now it supports CarPlay as well, but if you're using Apple Maps or using maps from CarPlay, then I guess it turns off the Google Maps in the cluster, and it doesn't. It has no way of showing you the Apple Maps as an alternative in there, which is unfortunate. Hopefully that's something they fix in the future, and I'll make sure next time I talk to somebody from Volvo, I mention that to them.
I will say that Apple is sort of a pain to work with. If you're anyone, yeah. Working with Apple is very, very difficult. So
yeah,
I think yeah. So I'm just gonna throw that out there.
Yeah, I mean, it probably would be difficult to impossible to get the Apple Maps stuff up there. As an alternative, you know, they could just leave the Google Maps display in the cluster that just shows you where you are. It's not going to show you a route if you're using Apple Maps from CarPlay, but it can just keep displaying the Google Maps display.
Yeah, I think the how they have it set up in the Volvos, the Android, it's really nice because it shows like charge stations along mm-hmm. your route. It is all those things that you kind of want it to do anyway. So,
yeah.
And then you can still do your text messaging with CarPlay and listening to your random music or your podcast in something that you're used to.
Yeah. All right. While we're on this topic, that one thing I did forget to mention about the Lucid is it's even with the new UX, it still doesn't have support for Android Auto or Apple CarPlay, but it does have a bunch of apps built in, media streaming apps built in. So you've got Spotify, Tidal, there's a couple other ones. Pocket Casts is actually built in there. So you can use that. You can log into your Pocket Casts account if you've got one and just get all your podcasts downloaded directly into the car. And it'll sync up with, if you're using Pocket Cast on your phone or tablet or computer, it all syncs across there. So that is handy.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of people using Spotify, a lot of people using Tidal. Apple Music would be nice. But again, it's Apple. So it's.
Yeah.
It can be. But they have all the Apple people there now. So.
Right. And, Apple does have deals with some automakers to include an Apple Music app in there. I think
Porsche,
BMW has Apple Music in there now on the new 7 Series, and I think on the X7. I think it might actually be just on everything with the iDrive OS 8 version has that on there. So, yeah. All right, that's it for this time, relatively shorter one. I do have an interview that I recorded with Daniel Weisland, who's the president of Audi of America. I recorded this with him a few weeks back, And so I will tack that on here now, and we'll say goodbye until next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Ben, it's Daniel. How are you doing?
Hello, Daniel. Pleasure to meet you.
My pleasure. I hope you can hear me loud and clear.
Absolutely, yeah. It's great.
Sam, I'm Wei Wan. I lead corporate communications for Audi of America. I'm just going to sit here in the background while you guys chat. Thank you for taking the time with us.
All right. Thank you. So, Daniel, as I said, pleasure to meet you. Let's talk about Audi. Where do you see the brand today? What are the highlights of what's going on with Audi today? And then let's dive into where it's going in the future.
For Audi, clearly I can say our future is electric, and we are leading the way towards electrification. And that's a good reason doing so, because we all have a responsibility towards our children and grandchildren and protect our planet. Therefore, I think that's a big cause in order to go electrification. So we always say, like, what's good for the humans is also good for the business. And this is obviously our credo and our vision. Today, we are proud that we have the largest product portfolio of battery electric vehicles of any automaker here in the United States. After we launched the Q4 e-tron and Q4 e-tron Sportback, that means we have five different models on sale here in the United States.
The original e-tron and e-tron Sportback have been with us now for several years, and the e-tron GT is doing pretty well for its segment. The Q4 e-tron it's a smaller crossover electric. Have you actually started deliveries of that vehicle yet to customers?
Yes, we did start already deliveries to customers. However, we see a lot higher demands than we expected initially when we planned this product and production of that. And we're really happy to see that customers really like the car, they love the car. And it's also entry point towards electric premium model. With below $50,000, now you can buy an electric Audi, which is great and will enable us to even, get a bigger, fan base into electric vehicles.
How quickly do you anticipate transitioning the entire lineup to electrification? I think it's been previously reported that Audi globally will launch its last internal combustion engines around 2026. What do you see as the time frame for the transition in North America to electrification?
That's the same time frame as on a global level, since we also obviously somehow connected to the global strategy and the global launching and the global production. So starting in 2026, we will only launch new vehicles, fully electric vehicles. That still means we have ICE vehicles on sale for a certain time, because we, until 2026, we still also going to launch ICE vehicles, and our last ICE vehicles will be the best ICE vehicles. So also here we still invest heavily to make sure that we basically lead the transformation of our customers from, call it, ICE vehicles into electric vehicles, because not everybody today maybe is ready to buy a full electric vehicle. We still have the infrastructure challenges. We maybe still have some, challenges at in terms of range anxiety. But I believe in the next 5 years that most of our consumers will follow us into the electric future.
Do you see plug-in hybrids continuing to be part of the lineup for at least through the remainder of this decade as well?
We will have a few plug-in hybrids, but plug-in hybrids is more a transition technology. It gives you both worlds at the same time, but the future clearly is fully electric.
Okay. The Q4 is on the MEB platform that's shared across a variety of VW Group brands. How many EV platforms do you anticipate having? You've also got the new PPE platform that's coming up that you've been collaborating with Porsche on. How many EV platforms do you think are needed to support the entire
Audi lineup?
I think you need to constantly develop your platforms. You can't rely on one, two, three platforms for the rest of the, you know, decade or even beyond 2030. So we constantly need to develop and re-engineer those platforms. And yes, of course, you need platforms for lower or smaller cars. You need the platforms for bigger cars. You need platforms who can have, you know, are ready for SUVs and some for sedans. So obviously, it also depends on your portfolio, but we try to leverage synergies within the Volkswagen Group. But as I said, constantly develop also those platforms and not rely on two or three platforms. That's, you know, you're going to see a lot of more development than just the MEB, PP, and then SSP platforms.
Okay. The Q5 e-tron plug-in hybrid is already produced in Mexico. With the Inflation Reduction Act that was passed, there's definitely strong incentives to localize production, and even without that, you know, there are incentives from a business perspective, especially with EVs, to try to localize production to the degree you can, you know, to in order to support, you know, a corporate move towards decarbonization, you know, less logistics costs, less transportation of materials and things, you know, around the world. Do you see, you know, is an expansion of production in North America, or I guess regional production, something that's in the cards for Audi of America?
We constantly do evaluate different opportunities and scenarios. How can we bring more electric vehicles to our customers in a more sustainable way? And it's not just in terms of production, where we produce those cars. It's also about what kind of materials we use. Where do we source those materials? And as you know, probably the group also just signed an agreement with the Canadian government a few weeks ago how to source materials in a sustainable way. It's also about recycling. So with Redwood Materials, we have a partnership and cooperation also to make sure that we recycle batteries in a sustainable way. And that's, I think you need to look at the big picture, not just where you produce, but again, like how can we reduce the CO2 footprint and become net carbon neutral as a company in total?
Okay. You mentioned Redwood, you know, and the deal with the Canadian government, you know, as part of a larger mobility ecosystem, e-mobility ecosystem, a number of companies, you know, are expanding their footprint into areas beyond just vehicle production and sales, you know, support, moving into areas, like stationary storage systems, bi-directional charging capabilities, vehicle to home, vehicle to grid. Is that something that Audi is looking at expanding your presence in these other areas of the ecosystem?
Yeah, first I think we look at the whole supply chain, how to make sure that we reduce the CO2 footprint as much as possible, and we also look beyond our, let's say, core business model of selling, servicing cars, and the cars of the future will have the opportunity of bi-directional charging. So ideally, then your car will also be able to charge your house in case you know, the electricity goes down. And I speak for myself, like you know, every other month or so, electricity goes off, sometimes for a few minutes, sometimes for an hour. And I know that many households have a diesel generator protecting that the electricity completely goes away. And in the future, if the car in your garage can basically, you know, provide the electricity you need for your house, wouldn't that be great? You know, on the one side, you would actually save to buy this diesel generator who just makes noise and, you know, also produce a lot of CO2 emissions. And that's definitely future. So, yes, we develop on that, and we look at always opportunities. How can we, you know, makes this become a better world, and again, protect it and make it more sustainable.
Speaking of sales, you know, some companies, obviously a lot of the newer entrants into the marketplace, you know, that don't have existing dealer networks, have moved, have largely adopted a direct sales model. That's not necessarily something that is that's available to somebody like Audi, where you have existing dealers. But how do you see the sales model evolving in the coming years?
I think it's important. It needs to be customer-centric. The customer needs to be at the center of everything we do. And no matter if it's a direct sales model or, like, I call it a traditional sales model, we need to also evolve and transform ourselves. And we have a lot of discussions with our dealer partners, but our dealer partners are an essential part of our business model also going forward. But on the other side, we need to ensure that from a customer perspective, it's a seamless customer journey, independent if I want to go to a dealer or not. But you should not forget, dealers are very strongly connected to their communities. Dealers are ambassadors for the Audi brand, and still many of our customers like to have the human touch as part of their investment into a vehicle. You should not forget also buying an electric car or buying a car in general is usually the second biggest investment after buying a house or a condo. And therefore, many customers still want to touch and feel things. They also want to, you know, have the confidence that when I have a problem with my car, I have somebody taking care of me and my car. Some of those new players you mentioned don't have the ability. So I think it's, for us, it's a big asset we have, and we shouldn't give it up. But yes, we need to also make sure that we evolve the way we're doing business and become more customer-centric.
You mentioned the human touch. Do you think that for a premium brand like Audi, as opposed to a more lower cost, more mainstream brand, is there a difference, for the customers of those brands? Do the premium customer maybe want more of that versus somebody who's buying a lower priced vehicle?
I would say every customer is different, independent of, let's say, household income, independent of what car they want to buy. Even if you compare two Audi e-tron buyers, I'm sure they all have different expectations. And that's the key of success going forward, that you're able to deliver according to the expectations of our customer. And I wouldn't make a difference between a volume brand and a premium brand. Yes, premium brand, in average, I would say our customers have higher expectations than they should, because they also pay a higher price. But also here, every customer is somehow different, and that's always a challenge, where a human touch can give you this ideal, individualized customer experience better than you do it maybe on your computer.
Okay. One of the things we've seen, especially over the last 2 years, digital sales models. You mentioned, doing sales over the computer. Is Audi going to move further into that sort of digital sales model in collaboration with your dealers, where a customer can go in and configure a vehicle online and do most of the ordering process online, and then take final delivery from the dealer and get their service and training about the vehicle?
Yes, we have a clear roadmap already defined with our dealer partners. We launched in July e-deposit on all the electric vehicles, we're gonna start a pilot before the end of the year with certain dealer partners, where we have the full online buying process for electric models, and then we're gonna continue to scale it and roll it out across the network, across all models. So we have a clear plan to do so, because we feel it's important for our customers. Customers wanna have the flexibility to do certain things online and maybe in store. And therefore, we need to have full flexibility. Yes, it's on its way already.
How do you see the dealer model evolving? As you get more into EVs, where potentially the vehicles require less service, less maintenance over their lifespan, and also you start to get into over the air software updates, where customers don't have to take the vehicle to a dealer to have a software reflash. How are you working with your dealers to help them make the transition into this new era, where they're losing some of the potential revenue streams that they have today?
I mean, first and foremost, the most important is to have open communication and a constant communication. I would say to my team, there's no over communication. You know, we need to make sure that you bring your dealer partners along the way. And actually, they're looking towards us for a clear direction into the future for the next 5, 10 years and even beyond, because they're all heavily invested into the Audi brand. They have multi-million dollar investments in their dealerships. And we need them too, also in the future. So there are certain aspects of the business which maybe in the future will change. But I can tell you, we have lots of opportunities where today we're not really exploiting those opportunities. We're losing many customers, like after maybe the warranty expires, and we're losing more customers if the car gets maybe 8, 9, 10 years old. And how can we keep those customers, those Audi fans in the family for lifetime? This is definitely a topic we can constantly discuss with our dealer partners, over-the-air updates, like on software. This is, again, helping our customers to save time. It's a lot easier, and also actually helps our dealerships in their capacity. Right now, we have so many capacity constraints at the dealerships to really service cars. And on top, if a customer comes in for those software updates, if we in the future can do that over the air, it also helps the business model of our dealers.
Okay. Another part of the EV customer experience is charging, which we touched on a little bit earlier. Obviously, as part of Volkswagen of America, you've got Electrify America within the group. But in Europe and Germany, for example, I believe it was Audi has shown off as prototype of the charging hub, where, you know, you have a lounge, you know, upstairs, and you have the chargers downstairs, and customers can go in and sit and relax and have a coffee. Do you see that? Do you expect Audi of America to perhaps invest in some of that, either in addition to what Electrify America is doing, or perhaps in partnership with EA, setting up some of those sorts of charging stations?
We're also looking at opportunities. Again, we would always do that in partnership with Electrify America, as it's part of the Volkswagen Group. But don't make any mistake. I mean, you can't have those hubs all over the country. Germany is a lot smaller than the U.S. is. And yes, you might have one or two or whatever in some metropolitan areas where we think it might make sense to improve the customer experience, but in such a big country like the United States, I think the key element is to have a fast charging network on the highways. And for the rest, we see it already today, more than 80% of our customers charge at home. And therefore, those charging hubs where you spend hours, it would not work at the majority of the countries, you know, especially in the countryside. So therefore, our focus is, yes, home charging, priority number one, fast charging on the highways, and then maybe we have a few pilots where we think, okay, that might make sense to have a charging hub similar like what they have in Nuremberg in Germany.
Okay. Speaking of home charging, one of the interesting technology areas that's, you know, a lot of people have had interest in but hasn't really gained much traction so far is wireless charging. Is that something that Audi is looking at, particularly, as you have premium customers that might be willing to pay a premium for that convenience? Is that something we might expect to see in Audi EVs in the coming years?
Again, I think it depends on the customer needs and requirements. You should not forget inductive charging you're referring to. First of all, the investment is a complete different investment level than you would have with a charger or a wall box. And then inductive charging usually, and I'm not the engineer, but inductive charging, I think it's not as efficient as it is with a cable through the wall box. But again, those technology might evolve going forward. But the possibility does exist. I know that we have those prototypes of cars already tested. But again, like ultimately, it's what the customer needs and expect. And so far, I honestly, I haven't heard any customer screaming for inductive charging. So right now, we see the wall box as the preferred solution for home charging.
Okay. Looking at the Audi portfolio in North America, are you satisfied with the portfolio of products, at least in terms of the form factors, you know, different segments that you're in? And do you see any opportunities that you're missing or that you would like to grow the Audi brand into, or perhaps, you know, segments that, you know, maybe Audi doesn't need to be in that it is in today?
So definitely our key objective is to transform our existing portfolio towards a more electric portfolio. And as I mentioned at the beginning, today we have already the largest product portfolio of any automaker if it comes to battery electric vehicles. And ultimately, we want to be present in every segment which is relevant for our premium customers. And yes, there's a lot of investment happening until 2025. The company will invest 19 billion euro on a global level just for electrification, and that will enable us to bring a lot more electric vehicles to the market, and then ideally have a car at every price point, at every kind of shape, segmentation, which is relevant for our premium customers.
Okay. One last topic I'd like to delve into. Back in 2018, when the current generation A8 was launched, one of the features that, you know, was talked about, at least in Europe, was Traffic Jam Pilot, a level 3 type of driving assistance, partially automated system. That never made it to the U.S. market. I don't think it ever really got deployed in Europe either. We're starting to see some of your competitors starting to launch similar systems now. What do you see as for automated driving within the Audi consumer portfolio? What's your strategy for that?
I think it's very important that we continue to develop and invest in autonomous driving assistant features. And we have already today certain autonomous driving assistant features, you know, call it level 2 or level 2 plus. And we continue to invest in that. But also one thing which is very, very, very important for us is we're only going to launch something if it's 100% safe and secure for our customers to drive. We would not risk or jeopardize our brand image by launching something where then I see in the headline somebody was killed in a car driving an autopilot, and the autopilot didn't recognize a truck in front of him because for whatever reason. And and therefore, you know, you don't always have to be first in everything to market. You need to make sure that, especially if it comes to autonomous driving, so that safety and security is more important than anything else.
Okay. Last topic I want to hit is connectivity. Audi, you know, has had built-in connectivity in its vehicles for many years. And this year, I think you did a good thing for your customers of some of your older products with your partnership with Mojio to support the transition from 3G to 4G. Another area that Audi's been heavily involved in is testing of vehicle to everything communications. You've had the traffic light information system for a number of years in most of your products, but you've also been working with Qualcomm and other partners on cellular V2X. Is that something you see as coming to production vehicles anytime in the foreseeable future?
Yes, for sure. I mean, you know, there's always certain challenges we have. The one challenge you mentioned earlier said we have already over 2 million cars in the market. So, and some of those cars obviously were built 5-10 years ago. And, you know, therefore, also you mentioned the retrofit on those Moji dongles to enable even some of those older cars to be more connected or be connected. Going forward, yes, our cars will be more and more connected, but also here it's important, it's the infrastructure. Because it just doesn't help if the car can do it, if your infrastructure is not ready. You mentioned the traffic light assist. This only works also if the infrastructure is supporting it. Uh-huh. It doesn't work everywhere. So we have to go in locksteps with other industries. We have to go in locksteps with government and city development in order so it's really successful and the experience is great for our customers. Because on the one side, you can prepare the car for it, but if you don't have the infrastructure for it, then you might not get the full benefit from a customer perspective.
All right. Anything else that you should be thinking about for Audi that we haven't talked about?
Look, Audi is leading the way into electrification. I think that's important. We even are pushing the Formula One into electrification. And I'm really proud of that, that Audi is really leading the way, pushing towards an electric future to protect our planet for our generation, for our next generation. And I think we do the right thing, not just for the business, for our brand, but the right thing for the people, for the human beings here.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. Best regards. And it was nice talking to you.
All right. Have a great day.